Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A major piece of Ferguson-related legislation relating to municipal fines and fees is being challenged in court. The U.S. Supreme Court sides with police on use of force, and some legislators want to make an end run around Governor Nixon on the Syrian refugee question. These issues and more for today's Legal Roundtable panel. Joining me are attorneys Bill Freivogel, professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor at Washington University and director of the Career Center there. Also with us is Esther Seitz, an attorney with the Donald M. Craven Law Firm in Springfield, Illinois. Esther, thank you so much for coming all this way just to be with us today. Nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're looking forward to our discussion. Mark Smith, I'm going to start with you. I guess the most meaningful Ferguson-related legislation to come out of the legislature this year dealt with municipal court reform and the fines and fees being the big issue there. Now a dozen North County municipalities are challenging that in court. What's the problem with it?
So the Senate bill limited the percentage
Senate Bill 5.
Yes, yeah, Senate Bill 5 limited the percentage of revenue that they could collect from fees to, I think, 15% or 12.5, actually. And
from 30, I think, in some cases.
Yeah, much larger. So there's basically two bases for the lawsuit. One basis is you're treating this area differently than other areas in the state, other counties in the state, and that you should treat all counties the same. The second complaint is there also to Senate Bill 5, there were some requirements about police departments and governments. They had to have audit reports, and so they're alleging this is a Hancock violation. Hancock was the law that was passed, I think, it was a referendum that was passed in the early 80s.
A generation ago.
Yeah, that said if the state puts some new burden on a municipality, they have to provide funding. And so they're saying you're providing this burden with no funding. So, I mean, I looked at their filing. Obviously, the other side hasn't responded, but they both seem to pass the laugh test to me. The lawyer who's involved is from out of town. He's at Ballard Spahr, which is a big Philadelphia firm. Seems like a pretty impressive guy. So I'm not sure how he got involved with this lawsuit. That was what I was asking beforehand. But it looks like I think this lawsuit stands a chance.
Yeah, I think it's a strong lawsuit. I mean, this is an issue that was brought up before the bill was passed. I wrote about this back then, and there are previous Missouri Supreme Court decisions saying, you know, you can't treat one part of the state differently than another part of the state unless you have a really good reason. So you've got, there's not only the challenge that this is a special law directed at one particular part of the state when you really should have a general law that affects the entire state, but also, as Mark said, a violation of the Hancock Amendment of not imposing additional monetary burdens on a municipality without giving them some money. And then also they claim it's a violation of the separation of powers as well. This is up to the, you know, this should be up to the Missouri Supreme Court, not up to the Missouri legislature.
So don't you think if they got rid of the extra requirements and put this limit on all counties, that they'd probably be good?
Yeah, but I don't think that all counties would agree to the limit.
Good, right.
So you know, they did lower it for the other counties to 20%. So it's 12.5% in St. Louis County, 20% in the whole rest of the state. And I don't think they ever could have passed it through the legislature if they'd been 12.5 for everybody.
Right.
But can't we conclude the real problem with these counties is the fact they're going to be losing so much revenue as a result of the reduced fines and fees that is the real problem for them. Some of them, as we've discussed many times before, could go belly up as a result of this. That's perhaps the crux of the matter, really.
Yeah, even though they said in the press conference this isn't about money, it's about a fair playing field. It is about money. But, you know, there's an irony of this whole thing. As you said, Don, this is the main piece of quote-unquote Ferguson legislation passed. It doesn't really have much effect on Ferguson, at least the 12.5% cap. And the municipalities where it's having the big effect are the African-American-controlled municipalities in North County. So it's actually this sort of incipient, just early leadership in the African-American political community that's suffering and that's filing this challenge.
Right. Esther, is this something that folks in Springfield are looking at all? I mean, that's a couple hundred miles away almost.
I think it's an issue that's particular to Missouri or to, really a problem for St. Louis and specifically.
Well, you're somewhat far removed from some of these issues today, so. But feel free to speak up when you've got something to say.
This law was probably intended to put some of these municipalities out of business. I would say more than just take it, the idea is we want to unify things. And so you got this real challenge. Like Bill identified, one of the implications is now many of these that it's hitting the strongest are the African-American communities where you could get maybe some leadership out. I think we're going to talk about some of the things that County Executive Stanger has done in terms of some suggestions of the police department. I think the same kind of goal. Let's try and get this all together. It might make things more professional. It might be a better form of government. But I think you also have people who say, I'd rather be, rule in hell than serve in heaven, I think that was Milton who said that. But the idea that I don't care if we're falling apart, I'm in charge, and I want to stay in charge, and I don't want to give up my power to go into a better, larger government.
Well, while you've mentioned opposition to County Executive Stanger, let's just talk about that for a moment. Basically, what he wants to do is to standardize procedures among 57, I think it is, county police departments, have them all working off of the same page, basically. And there's a unified opposition to that, apparently, Bill.
Yeah, the municipalities, the St. Louis County Municipal League, is opposed to it. They're saying that that the county cannot enforce standards, even if they might be great standards. They can't enforce them on the municipalities, which are sovereign. It seems as though the Stinger is making the argument that because the county council has the authority to act in when public health is involved, that gives them the authority to impose these standards. And it's a little bit of a stretch to say that, police, that rules on police, training and conduct fall under public health.
More like
public safety.
The Commerce Clause? We get everything the Commerce Clause for the feds.
Yeah, but this is no Commerce Clause.
And I do think that when police officers are poorly trained, then that does implicate public safety and public health. So certainly I think that creating a certain set of minimum standards does affect public health. I think the question really becomes, is there a problem in the training of the police officers that are currently serving with some of the police departments?
And I think the answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's no question but that these standards that Stinger is trying to impose are good ones. And, that they should have a use of force policy. They should be in business 24 hours a day.
Background checks on new hires.
Background checks that you should report. That the police department should have a requirement of having to report to the state when a particular officer has violated rules or laws. So these are all good. They're all good ideas. It's just a question whether or not the county can impose them or the state. I mean, the Municipal League is saying that has to be something that the state legislature does.
Yeah, but these are all ideas, too, that came out of the Ferguson Commission, too, basically.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of public
And the Ferguson Commission, I think, has had a very positive response to Sanger's proposal. But you've got, once again, these little municipalities raising the issue of sovereignty, that we should be able to do what we want and you shouldn't have other people telling us. And
I mean, legal issues aside, we'd be in a lot better shape if a lot of these police departments went out of business.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd be in better shape as far as how good our law enforcement in St. Louis County was.
There is so much waste and inefficiency with regard to all these departments with different communication systems and, different procedures and all the rest of it. There's no question it would be more efficient if there were a single police department.
And you have the post certification that's supposed to collect if some police officer gets fired or does something bad, they're supposed to keep this. But my experience from 10 years ago was a lot of times, I think the city of St. Louis was very good at checking backgrounds, but smaller municipalities would let somebody come on who had a history of problems, and then they then they move on to the next municipality.
Thank you for reminding us once again that you were once a member of the St. Louis Police Board, Mark.
If you would refer to me as Colonel Dunn, I would really appreciate that.
Your eminence. Let's take a call here, because before we get too far away from the fines and fees issue, let's bring in Jim calling from Kirkwood. Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
You're right about the police need better training, but you know, these little municipal courts have run rampant. I mean, I have a rental property in Maplewood, and I've been in that court many times for small housing issue. I could have a clump of grass by my right up next to the house that was maybe 10 inches, and I'd get fined for that. And when you question the judge there, I've been told before to shut up. I've been told before, your fine's $200, and I just had this happen the other day. I said, $200 is normally $50. He said, you want me to make it $300? Keep talking. It's not justice. It's whatever they feel like doing. And, you know, if they can't afford to be in business, they need to be, you know, consolidated. You know, Maplewood just spent a bunch of money building new city hall. A lot of these municipalities built new city halls during a recession.
Jim, we thank you for the call. I'm sorry to be abrupt with you, but we do have to move on. And don't feel like you're the only one who's ever been told to shut up.
Oh, I know I'm not.
But I do think, I mean, my experience, you know, I tried cases. It's been a long time, but I go up for jury duty and things. My experience is most members of the judiciary are very polite and recognize but I know there are these outlier situations, and I think that's bad for the legal profession. It's bad for our confidence in the whole system. People, you know, judges, whether they're municipal judges or federal court judges, should be treating people with respect. And
well, Jim's story is not an unusual one.
We've
heard it many times, and particularly in the African-American community. Yeah.
I do think that in the long term, the best solution for the municipal courts is the kind of thing that Arch City Defenders has suggested of, you know, consolidating them. Yeah. They could be consolidated in. There are now three St. Louis County municipal courts, you know, for the municipal violations that occur outside of little cities. And those could easily be used to handle all of the municipal violations. And similarly, we really need to have standardized police training and use of force policies all through the St. Louis County Police Department.
Sure. We have to take a break now. We'll do that. We'll come back and talk about a number of other things that are on our agenda for today. This is our legal roundtable discussion with Bill Freivogel, from whom you just heard. Mark Smith is with us from Washington University. Also joining us is Esther Seitz. She is with the Donald M. Craven Law Firm in Springfield, Illinois. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Esther Seitz, Mark Smith, and Bill Freivogel. The next thing I'd like to talk about is the recent demonstrations at the University of Missouri. The demonstrations, of course, focused on racial insensitivity. But there are a number of legal issues that were raised during the course of those demonstrations. Bill, what were some of them?
Well, it was sort of a beautiful it wasn't really beautiful, but it was there was for those of us who are First Amendment lawyers, the confrontation between some of the students, student demonstrators on the one hand, and the student journalists on the other hand, was an interesting lesson in First Amendment law. There was this a lot of people saw the video of demonstrators confronting a student photographer who was working for, I think, ESPN, and sort of insisting he move back and not take their picture. And there was an exchange between the students and the student photographer, in which the student photographer very beautifully said, you know, it's the same First Amendment that gives you the right to be out here demonstrating, gives me the right to record it and to take a picture of it. And then, you know, that was followed then by a communications professor, I think her name's Melissa Click, being horrifying all communications and journalism professors around the country and calling for some muscle to come over and get the reporters out from the circle that the demonstrators had formed. You know, she ended up apologizing and resigning her courtesy appointment to to the journalism school. So it was an interesting day.
Ironic that Missouri has one of the most prestigious journalism schools in the country, and all this happened there. Any other thoughts about that,
well,
folks?
Well, here's what I would say. I mean, you know, and Bill is the journalist, so he cares about this more than I do, I think. And I
we
care
should all
about
care,
it.
Mark.
I know. No, I do care. But I think, particularly with those kids, they're 18 to 22. They make bad choices sometimes. And I would think if you had a discussion about it, maybe they could figure out, but they're caught up in the motion. This woman, I have less sympathy because she's an adult. She's supposed to know about this and calling for muscle. But she apologized. So what do you, I mean, I think everyone's saying, yeah, that was a bad call on our part. We shouldn't have done that. But I don't think, I mean, it was made kind of in the heat of the moment, and I don't think it's some major attack on the First Amendment. I think it was just a bunch of 18 to 22-year-olds caught up in a moment and making a bad choice, and that's what I think.
I think they probably weren't thinking about the fact that this the situation triggers First Amendment protections because it's a matter of public interest, and it's in a public space, and therefore everybody has a right to be there, and quite frankly, the news has a right to report on it, but I think that they were probably bullying the guy a little bit, and I mean neither of those things are good.
No, it's not good. But also, what about this? Aren't there any journalism ethics? I mean, is if you're trying to take
a
picture, so I mean, is a picture always required in every situation? And they were kind of saying to this guy,
but that's not the question.
Well, they were saying, can't you give these people their space? They don't want to be photographed right now.
Then they shouldn't be protesting on a public issue in a public space.
So anytime I'm in a public space, no matter how intimate or
you
private...
You have no expectation of privacy.
I know I don't have an expectation of privacy, but aren't there times when you would just say, okay, we're not going to take this photograph?
I mean, there might be a journalist, say a photojournalist might, you know, if he comes across...
And I'm not saying this is necessarily that situation.
No, it isn't that kind of situation. But if a photojournalist came across some sort of horrible accident on a highway, maybe, maybe he or she would choose not to take a picture of the gruesome, the gruesome scene. But this is very much, not that situation. And a photographer shouldn't have to justify, oh, well, this was an important photo, even though most of the protest was over, this was an important, picture because, these are the demonstrators. It was the biggest story going in the nation that day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think that, I think if you required a photojournalist to justify it, he could easily have justified it. But photojournalists shouldn't have to justify taking a picture in a public space of a public protest.
Well, there's another element here, I think, and that is that demonstrators frequently don't like to have their picture taken because when their picture is taken, it puts them at the scene of possibly a crime or violence or something that
or their mom and dad find out.
Well, yeah, that can happen too. And there is a certain distrust on the part of some people of media in this regard.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that I'm not sympathetic to the protesters' actions. I mean, I think they did. I'm very sympathetic to the organization, Concerned Students 1915. I think they had very strong demands. But then, sort of more broadly, outside of Mizzou, I think that I am concerned, although I don't really have, I wish I had the answers, I'm concerned about this sort of clash between students, sort of righteous demands for there to be racial sensibilities on campus and other places, on the one hand, and then the freedom of speech and academic freedom on the other. I mean, you just have to look at this sort of the confrontation between the resident faculty resident at Yale and the demonstrators who were attacking him and Princeton's consideration of taking Woodrow Wilson off the Woodrow Wilson School, Louisville president apologizing for having had a party where he and his staff had sombreros on. There's a lot of these sort of clashes that are going on around the country, and it's not easy to sort of say, okay, so here's the line.
No, and we've got evolving notions of what's appropriate, not appropriate, and evolving ideas of, where are we going to turn a blind eye to, okay, this guy, and it's usually a guy, was 90% a great guy, but then we find out well, there's these really bad things, and how are we going to look upon that?
Yeah. Let's move on to something else now. We've dealt with Mizzou. We've all been reading about the governors. I think there are 31 of them, governors in the United States, who want to put a ban on Syrian refugees coming to their states. Governor Nixon in Missouri is not one of them. He refuses to abide by or support such a ban. Governor Rauner in Illinois is all for it, as I understand it. Do these 30 governors, however many there are, do they have a constitutional leg to stand upon in their resistance to this, or are they way off base?
I think as a matter of constitutional law, really it's within the domain of federal law to regulate immigration matters. This is an immigration matter, and therefore the governors cannot really block the refugees coming in. I think they can make it less welcoming of an environment. Mm. And I suspect that some of the Republican governors, especially in Illinois where money is tight, will probably just not make it all that fun to be there. And that may in and of itself curb the flow of immigrants into those states.
Here in the state of Missouri, there are calls for a special legislative session to, as one of the sponsors of that sort of thing is saying, it's to tie the governor's hands and stop the, quote, potential Islamization of Missouri. And they're also talking about establishing refugee camps until they can send these folks back. Well, the question is, suppose the legislature did go into special session and suppose it did create a law banning Syrian refugees from coming here, could that stand?
No.
If it's a federal deal?
No, it would be a colossal waste of time. Just like when we banned Sharia law in Missouri. I mean, it's just maddening.
Esther, do you know that we worked on that?
I didn't know that, but yeah,
we also banned
preemption.
UN resolution being implemented in Missouri. I had to look it up. I didn't even know what they were talking about. How these guys find out? They have time to find out about it? It's just maddening.
But this is a federal matter.
Yeah,
and also the president is commander in chief. It falls under – he has powers as commander-in-chief to make some of these decisions about which because I think he has made the argument very cogently that those governors and Republican presidential candidates who are saying keep these people out are handing ISIS exactly what
right,
they want.
Right, right, right.
You know, look, the people in America are racist.
But this is classic supremacy clause. The states are preempted. That's the legal term. And there was that case in Arizona that went to the Supreme Court where the Supreme Court reminded everyone of that. So now, you know, I saw Francis Lay tweeted apparently something very nice about we should be welcoming. And I guess it's a little politically easier for him, although I'm sure there's some risk for him to do that. I thought Jay Nixon, and I understand he's in a very difficult position, but his statement, which was two sentences, and it was basically the terrorists are bad, we ought to catch them, and we'll leave this, and I have great confidence that I would have liked to have seen something a little more inspirational, but he's in a difficult position. And
But Syrian refugee does not equate to terrorists.
I know.
And that's the fallacy.
Thing that the refugees are the people we should be concentrating on. I mean, this process is 18 to 24 months long.
Yeah.
If there are Syrians who are going to try to get into the country to conduct terrorist operations, they're not going to do it as refugees. They're going to try to come on tourist visa or whatever.
Student visa.
That initial boat ride is a little bit difficult. I can't imagine too many terrorists want to take that risk before coming over. Okay, speaking of the Supreme Court and speaking of Obama and speaking of immigration, his executive order on immigration is now going to the Supreme Court. The question and that would involve some 5 million refugees, primarily from Mexico and Central America, who would be deported if, in fact, the executive order were not to stand. My question is, in taking this to the Supreme Court, is what is really being taken there the executive order process? Because that carries so much political baggage these days. What do you think? Any thoughts about that?
Is my question clear?
Yeah.
I mean, the very specific issue that the lower courts have ruled on, or the lower court judge ruled on, is that if this executive order were to be put into effect, you had to go through the whole comment procedure in it before it was put into effect. That it's a substantive change that affects the states, and so you need to have a whole comment procedure. And by not doing that, they violated what's it called, the Administrative Procedure
Act.
So we'll see. I mean, the Obama administration makes the argument that the states don't even have legal standing to challenge it. That this is an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. There's only about enough money to expel about 400,000 illegal immigrants every year. And so why are we – so it's the decision of the president. Well, this 4 or 5 million Mexican-American immigrants who are the parents of U.S. citizens and legal U.S. residents, they're not going to be the first ones that we send out. That should be within the president's prosecutorial discretion. I think he has a good argument to make there.
And I think it's also parents of children that are U.S. Americans and don't have a criminal record. Mm-hmm. So they're really people that have been not posing a threat to safety.
But there has been so many complaints from the GOP side of the aisle in Congress about his use of executive orders. I wonder if the court rules against the Obama administration here, if the executive order process is somehow weakened in his ability to use the executive order.
I think presidents have used executive orders in immigration cases that were at least similar to this for many years, for many decades, both Republican and Democratic presidents. So, yeah, if the Obama administration were to eventually lose on this score, it would be curbing the power of the that the president has to use executive orders, at least in immigration kinds of cases.
Still with the Supreme Court, there's another issue that is back again. For the first time in a decade, an abortion measure is before the Supreme Court. I'll just have to read here. It will determine how far states may go in regulating the procedure without violating a woman's constitutional rights. This goes to the Texas case that we've talked about before, limiting the number of places where women can have abortion. My question here is this case in and of itself, does it have the legs, the grounding, if you will, to ultimately to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, or would it just be limited to this particular issue of Texas clinics?
I don't think it would actually overturn Roe v. Wade, because Wade or Roe held that a woman has a constitutional right to an abortion once at the first, I think the first and second trimester. That holding would not be overturned. However, I think that this case that's before the Supreme Court, Whole Woman's Health, may limit the ways in which a woman can exercise her right, because the law, it's a Texas law that is being challenged or that's at issue in this case, would limit what kind of hospitals could perform the procedures, what kind of physicians could perform the procedures. And if the law is upheld, then there would be much less clinics in Texas that would be able to perform abortions, and therefore the women that live there, some of them simply may not be able to obtain one. So it would indirectly chisel away at Roe.
So bite by bite, you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think so Roe versus Wade gave a high level of constitutional protection to a woman's right to have an abortion in the first part of pregnancy. And then 20 years after Roe, in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey, there was a challenge to, are we going to throw out Roe? And there was sort of and the Supreme Court said, we are reaffirming Roe, but we're not going to provide it with as much protection. Now we have this new standard, which Justice O'Connor came up with, undue burden. So the states can't do anything that constitutes an undue burden on a woman's right to have a constitutional right to have an abortion. But in the 20 years since then, we don't have clarity on exactly what is an undue burden. So Texas passes this law that says any doctor performing an abortion has to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles, and that all these abortion clinics have to be built to the standards of ambulatory surgical clinics. That this would cause like 40, the original 40 clinics in Texas to dwindle to about 10 and require women to travel much further to get an abortion and also further to be much longer delays. So the question is that we'll see and is what is – maybe the court will give us more specificity on what an undue burden is. That Planned Parenthood versus Casey case had a famous three-justice opinion. It was the Republican justices, you know, Republican-appointed justices, Kennedy, Souter, O'Connor, saying why they weren't going to throw out Roe versus Wade. You know, that so much time had passed, people had come to depend upon it.
Stare decisis.
Stare decisis, exactly. But Kennedy's the only one left, and he was always the weakest. He was the weakest of them. So we'll see where that ends up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would agree with exactly what they're saying, but I wouldn't completely rule out the idea of Roe maybe getting overturned. I think it would be highly unlikely, but we've seen the Supreme Court do that, you know, with the Citizens United case, where what started as kind of a small potatoes case all of a sudden becomes a huge case. And I don't know that Heller needed to go as far as it did. I don't think that's very likely at all. But, I mean, with this court, I think anything's possible.
I don't think this court would make the step. I mean, it would be a tremendously politically damaging step for the court to throw out Roe versus Wade when they hadn't even teed it up, in the issues before the court. But what they could very easily do is say, okay, all a state has to do is have a rational reason for what they're doing. And so, what Texas said was, we're just trying to protect women's health here. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that upheld the law said, "Hey, we have to. If the legislature says that, we got to believe them. Even if Governor Perry, in signing it, is saying, hey, what I'm trying to do is get rid of abortion."
And so we get this what we've had for the last 20 years since Casey, which is just chipping away by making it more restrictive.
Nibbling at the edges until it's gone someday.
Right.
I think they're not going to take away the right. They may just take away the way that one can actually make use of that right.
Mm-hmm. What's
the point of a right if you can't use it?
Right, it's pretty damaging that way.
I actually don't think that the Supreme Court will go as far as the Court of Appeals did down there, saying we just have to believe the legislature if they say they're trying to help out women's health, because they stayed the lower court, the Court of Appeals decision. So that I think that there were five justices there who said, hey, they've gone too far.
We have to take another break. Let's do that now. We'll come back. There's one other Supreme Court issue I want to talk about, then some local issues concerning our prosecutor here in the city of St. Louis, Jennifer Joyce. We're having our legal roundtable discussion with me in studio, our Mark Smith from Washington University, Bill Freivogel from SIU in Carbondale, and Esther Zeitz from Springfield, Illinois, joining us from the Don Lem Craven Law Firm. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. We were talking about Supreme Court issues a moment ago. We'll continue that for another minute or so. The High Court has ruled on a police use of force issue, reaffirming support for police use of deadly force. It stems from a Texas case ruling that police are immune from suits in lethal force cases unless it's beyond a doubt that it's justified. How does this ruling affect us here, in terms of what we've been going through with the use of force discussions that we've been having?
Well, it seems as though they haven't been – the Supreme Court hasn't paid too much attention to Ferguson.
Right.
because this is a case where a guy's in a high-speed chase. So he's trying to escape police. He's going 100 miles an hour, then down to 85. He's gone 25 miles, so he's definitely a threat. He's coming upon another sort of police attempt to stop him with some spikes in the highway. And so this one Texas officer who has been told previously he's not assertive enough by his superiors, decides he's going to be assertive this time. And so he gets on an overpass with a gun, and he sends over his radio that he's thinking about shooting at this, you know, trying to shoot out the radiator or
although
the engine block.
Although he's had no training.
No training.
How to shoot
never
it.
Been trained on yeah. that. And his superior comes back and says, you know, stand down. But he goes ahead and shoots. He hits the driver five times or four times maybe in the chest and kills him. As you said earlier, but the Supreme Court said – the Supreme Court has never recognized a situation where in a high-speed chase there was an unreasonable use of force to end it. And they said it has to be like clear incompetence on the part of the officer beyond debate that it was – unreasonable. Otherwise, the officer is legally immune from even being sued.
Yeah.
So it's status quo, which is basically where we were before.
Status quo, but this one even goes sort of farther than I don't know. The facts of this situation are, I think, more extreme than some of the previous high-speed chase, cases. Although some of those have been pretty extreme too.
Yeah. And we were saying there was a dissent by Justice Sotomayor, who I'm pretty sure was a federal prosecutor. And I found it interesting that she was in the defense because usually the people who acted as prosecutor tend to be more pro-police, and she was the one person not going for it. But I agree with Bill. It seems to me the Supreme Court is either tone deaf to what's happening or just says, we don't care, but they're basically saying – I mean, here you have a police officer who's going out kind of rogue saying, everyone said, let's do this. And he says, no, I'm going to start shooting at the car and then ends up killing the person. And they're going to say, well, okay, we'll let him slide on that one.
I think the Supreme Court just focused probably too much on its own jurisprudence and the case law from the Supreme Court just wasn't clear that an officer wasn't allowed to do that. And because of that, I think the Supreme Court right. was willing to extend the officer qualified immunity. Mm-hmm. But I think under those particular circumstances where the cop wasn't trained at doing that, it's not a real police technique to shoot at a moving vehicle in a high-speed chase. And they had the spikes up. There was an alternative right. to right. stopping right. the vehicle. Yeah. This was really kind
they of – they had deployed the spikes. He was coming under the bridge. They were there. So he shoots them before. Yeah.
It wasn't necessary.
The requirements that the Supreme Court has imposed when police are prosecuted or when, as in this case, they're being sued civilly are just very, very high burdens of proof and make it very difficult to use federal law to hold police accountable.
Let's while we're talking about the Supreme Court, we have Bob calling from Millstadt, who's been waiting quite a while. He wants to raise a Supreme Court issue, I believe. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air. Bob, you there? I guess not. Well, let's move along. We can have our segue here with regard to use of force because here in the city of St. Louis, Jennifer Joyce, the circuit attorney, has asked for a special prosecutor to look into a fatal police shooting that took place last January. How unusual is this, Mark? You're the police guy. How unusual is it for our prosecutor to call for a special prosecutor?
This is the first time. This is the third one of these cases we've had come from this new police, what is it, the FUI or something.
FIU.
FIU, yeah, something. And they're so, yeah.
What is the FIU?
This is the city police special investigative unit.
It's called the
Force Investigative
yeah,
Unit.
Yeah. And so they don't recommend, they just report to the prosecutor. And so we had what was the case that just got ruled on with the knife?
Kajami Powell.
Powell, yeah. And so I looked at that report and it seemed pretty comprehensive. My understanding is it took a long time because according to the prosecutor's office, witnesses wouldn't speak. And I don't think that's uncommon and that Jennifer Joyce's office reached out to some of the folks in Ferguson to encourage people who knew these people to encourage them to come forward.
But the special prosecutor is a different case, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Well, this is – they're going to now give this case to the press
– The Powell case?
No, not the Powell case.
Okay. That's what I want to clarify.
This is the – who is this
one? It was from last January, I think. I don't have the name off the top of my
Holmes.
Head.
Holmes is the person's name. Yeah, Holmes.
But there was a police investigation into this thing, and the police had a report on it. And it's I guess the suggestion is she is not accepting the police report, that she's going ahead with a special prosecutor.
I think the reason she's going ahead with the special prosecutor is because one of the officers involved in the shooting had been known people within the circuit attorney's office. So I think she felt as though there was a potential for at least the appearance of a conflict of interest. And certainly coming after that scandalous situation involving Worrell, I'm sure she's very tuned in to that, you know, that possibility.
Let's stop here for a moment because I'm not sure everybody understands the Worrell case. A former assistant circuit attorney who was recently dismissed, resigned, because she came up with some evidence concerning a cop friend that was was bogus.
It's Bliss Barber Worrell, and she agreed to, I guess it was a plea agreement with federal authorities where she acknowledged that she had known that a police officer had beaten a handcuffed suspect and stuffed a gun down his throat. I don't know if she admits that she knew about the gun, the gun down his throat, but knew that he had beaten him up while handcuffed, and that so this is called this. I think the term is misprison of a felony. In other words, knowing about a felony and not taking the actions that you should take. She's agreed as part of this plea. I don't think she's going to go serve any kind of jail prison time. She's agreed as part of this plea to testify. And it's an ongoing investigation. Actually, there's also another prosecutor who left as part of this same situation, whose name was Deardorff. And they are both
related to the
daughters of the famous.
Well, she's the daughter-in-law of Todd Worrell,
right.
And yeah, Deardorff, I believe, is the Dan Deardorff's daughter. Okay,
I would think it would also affect their law license.
That's what I was thinking too.
But she's taken a job with a firm, from what I read.
Yeah,
that doesn't necessarily mean you get to keep your license. Just because you have a job, that generally the licensing authority, the Missouri Supreme Court, would yank your license and then law firms out of luck.
So maybe I wonder if there's been any kind of charge for some kind of ethical breach and because there are particular ethic rules for prosecutors, and then there are general ethic rules that we all have to abide by. So I was thinking the exact same thing. Now, that sometimes takes some time to do.
Right.
So it may be.
But the scene that her plea describes is one of a number of people in the circuit attorney's office sitting around and being aware of this, you know, clearly illegal use of police force.
That office seems to be in a little bit of disarray because there's been another recent firing, and that is that young Stephen Roberts, who is related to Michael Roberts and Steve Roberts Sr., former alderman and active politically here and in business terms for a long time. He's been fired. He's also running for circuit attorney in 2016, by the way, but Joyce will not be running. He complained that black prisoners were being treated differently in the city of St. Louis, and he was fired after that. Jennifer Joyce says it was a competency issue, not the other. But there is some disarray. There is some stuff going on.
I don't know that I would go as far as disarray. I mean, I think you had this—
Two circuit attorney, assistant circuit attorneys are
I think that's out. A. I think that's definitely a black guy. This may be, I mean, it's tough. Anytime you terminate somebody, you can't talk about their performance. And so, I mean, if he thinks he's being fired for some illegal reason, he's got lots of legal recourses he could take advantage of. I haven't seen that happen. So,
I mean, another way to look at it is that, I mean, I think Jennifer Joyce has actually toughened up quite a bit the way in which the circuit attorney's office handles these kinds of cases. I think she's given very detailed investigations and reports to the, was it Andre Myers and the Kajimi Powell cases that got so much public attention. And I think that they just, as soon as a responsible prosecutor heard what had was going on in this case involving Worrell, that the prosecutor, you know, immediately said, "Feds, we need you to come over and deal with this." So, you know, maybe in the past, maybe it's not so much disarray as really taking
things
this
seriously,
important
right.
issue seriously.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think that's more what's going on. And
you know, Roberts has only been in the office like a year, and he had had some sort of legal problems in another municipality.
In St. Charles County, that was an issue there as well.
I'm not so sure. We should think about that.
Okay. I have an email here from John. We'll deal with this very quickly. He heard in the news last week that a significant portion of the Department of Justice's Ferguson report has not been released, with the supposition that it would embarrass DOJ.
Have you heard anything?
No. I'm trying to think what it could have been. I mean, there have been at least four Ferguson reports. You know, there was the two that were released, one on the Michael Brown shooting and the second on the unconstitutional practices in Ferguson. Those were all back last March. And then in the end of the summer, in September and October, there was like an after-action report. There was a cops report on St. Louis County policing. So I'm not sure. I mean, you may be right that there's another one, but I'm not sure what it would be.
Are they all studies by the federal government?
Those are all Justice Department. Some of them by the Civil Rights Office of Civil Rights, and some of them by the COPS organization.
Only a couple of minutes left, and Esther and I were chatting just before we went on the air about something going on in your neck of the woods up in Springfield, Chicago area, more to that area, concerning Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, and an email situation that sounds remarkably like what we've been reading about concerning Hillary Clinton over the last good many months. What's going on?
Yes, it seems that Rahm Emanuel is taking a page from Hillary Clinton's playbook, in that he, too, is using his private email account and presumably his private smartphone to discuss and conduct city business. And he is claiming that those emails are not subject to the Freedom of Information Act, which is Illinois' version of the Sunshine Law. And there has been at least one case in Illinois that kind of really squarely addressed the issue, in the appellate court in that case that said very clearly that it doesn't matter whether or not the account that is used as a private or personal account, or whether the digital device is that's being used, the smartphone, is a private or public phone, but rather what matters is the content of the message, the content of the communication. And if it concerns city business, if it concerns state business, then it's fair game and it ought to be released subject to a public records request. Now, the public officials in Illinois seem to disagree. Rahm Emanuel is disagreeing. Phyllis Wise, who's the chancellor at the University of Illinois, was doing the same thing, discussing a university business on her private email account in order to skirt the Sunshine Law.
She was actually sending emails to other people saying, make sure you send this to my private email. And that was one of the reasons she ended up having to resign.
Yeah, her communications even showed that she was advising her colleagues, please move all correspondence to private accounts, because that way we don't have to disclose it if asked by under FOIA.
Well, it's interesting. We've talked about this before. The digital age is bringing with it a whole new set of issues, is it not?
But this doesn't seem any different than if we're on a board and we say, instead of talking about this at the board meeting, we're going to go to lunch beforehand and talk about it. I mean, that should be subject to that's subject to the Sunshine Law or the equivalent in Illinois. This just seems like kind of a bogus.
Well, except the conversation. I mean, if you're having lunch with somebody and it's a conversation. I mean,
not a one-on-one. We say we've got a seven-member board, so all seven of us go to lunch to talk about it.
Yeah. Is it getting a lot of buzz?
Yeah, it really is. And it I think it's probably, even though there's an appellate decision on point already, I suspect there's going to be another one, because it just doesn't seem to be clear enough yet.
Not going away. Well, we're going to have to go away because our time is up. Esther Seitz, thank you so much once again for being with us and coming down from Springfield to join our happy group. It's been a pleasure meeting you, and hope to have you back again sometime. Bill Freivogel, great to see you again. And Mark Smith, always good to see you. Thank you all for being with us for this edition of our Legal Roundtable. We'll be back in about a month, and by then it'll be Christmas time. Gee. Time is flying. Thank you all once again. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Andy Hahn, Executive Director of Campbell House, about the mysterious benefactor who for many years, a century ago, brought food for the boys at Father Dunn's old newsboys home. We'll also speak with two former refugees who recently became American citizens. We'll talk about what their first Thanksgiving was like in the U.S. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.